tweeting as well. I'm not sitting here texting. They've said it's okay for me to tweet Angus.
It's fine to tweet. But if anybody feels the need to tweet, tweet away. We thought we'd have a go at this because these books really complement each other. Inequality and the 1% has a lot about the 1% and the best off in society and the effects of the best off having so much. And Austerity Bites is about people who are definitely not in the 1%. In fact, people who are not in the 50% beneath the 1% in many cases. Although it's interesting to see what's happening to the middle of society at the moment. Now, what we thought we'd try and do, so I'm afraid you're guinea pigs for this, is to tell a series of very short stories about the different people that we've talked to and we've studied. So I'm going to start off, and I'm going to start off right at the top. There is more inequality within the 1% than there is within the other 99% of us. The 1% are not a homogeneous group. The bottom of the 1% have an income of about 160,000. Which may sound like a lot of money, but if you're in the 1%, that isn't a lot of money for a couple without kids. You need 200,000 if you've got kids to get in the 1%. The average income of the 1% in this country is about 330,000. But as you look inside the 1%, everybody in the 1% can look up at people with much, much more than them until you get to the very top. So I want to tell you a little bit about the very, very top of the 1%. The Sunday Times Rich List lets us identify these people. It details about 1,000 of them, and it tries to make a fairly good attempt at their wealth. Because once you get really rich, income really doesn't matter. It's a question about how much wealth you've got, and your wealth makes money. Of those 1,000 people in the Sunday Times Rich List, just under 500 of them are living in London. And the 500 living in London have more wealth than most of the rest of the rich list. 10 families in London have a quarter of all the wealth of the super rich in London. So you can be in the Sunday Times rich list and actually not feel that well off, because the people at the very top have many, many millions to play with. So what's it feel like to be at the very top? Now, I can't tell you that well. But in a way, I'm nearer to people at the very top of society than I am to people at the very bottom. When your family has multiples of millions, when you are, say, the 15th or 20th richest family in London, the kind of things that worry you are kidnap. You need to have a security detail. The security detail needs to stay with you most of the time. You mustn't let people know where you're going, and you need to worry about your children's security as well. You have a whole series of expenses because you have multiple properties in multiple different countries. You'll have people looking after your money for you, and they make your money grow magically. The family I'm thinking of, the money was made by the generation above them, so they just simply walked into this money. They've only ever known having this money. And the kind of things that you spend your money on, the things like racehorses. At the very top of the income distribution, racehorses are really liked because they're sleek and they're beautiful and you can own them. They're almost like slaves in a way that you can't yet own people in that way. So you might have racehorses that you own, you have places and parties that you have to go to, and of course you give to good causes. Giving to good causes is very important at the top. And you may give several millions to particular causes. You're constantly getting people trying to get you to give money. So we were talking about this earlier. You have celebrities turn up, famous people turn up, wanting their particular cause to be financed. So you have this constant stream of people really begging for cash, for I don't know, children dying in Africa, vaccinations, some other campaign. And you make a series of promises about giving money. And if any of you have ever been involved with the very, very, very rich, what people will say, although they will never say it in public, is that most of the time when the extremely rich promise money, they don't actually deliver it. Partly because they're embarrassed about being asked. The natural sort of thing is to say, oh yes, I'll do that. I'll help out with that. But they don't necessarily help out. But how do they feel about the rest of society? What kind of view do they have of the rest? My impression is that they think this is just how the world is. This is just how the world is. And some people have a lot, and most people don't. And there's no other way. This is just how it has to be. If you saw Bill Gates being interviewed in January at Davos, he was asked about inequality. And I think it was Jeremy Paxman who asked him. And he replied to Jeremy, "Well, what do you want? North Korea?" As being the only alternative to having these extremely rich people and philanthropy as a way forward, as a good way forward. Now, Bill Gates hires a lot of people to make him look good and to make him sound clever and to feed him words so that he can appear to be cleverer than he is. But somebody mucked up in January this year with that line. So Bill Gates more recently wrote a review of Piketty's book, which was quite a big move from his January position of North Korea. And I think because he's worried about his reputation. So the last thing I'll say about the family I'm thinking of at the very top, reputation really matters. What people think of you really matters. It might just be reputation amongst your small social group, but everybody has a social group. So it's not just important to be wearing the right Armani, to have the right kind of jet, the right kind of cars and the rest of it. You want to be seen as good people. And there's a kind of interesting weakness there at the top, because my impression of people at the very top, particularly ones who've inherited money, so they're not necessarily that driven. You have to be pretty driven to become incredibly rich. The first million is almost always made illegally. I'm going to say that over. Whenever you look at the very rich, never ask where the first million came from. Those people can be a bit dangerous, but the ones who've inherited the money onwards are often a little bit more normal, but they want to be loved, but they don't think there's any way in which the world really can be organised in another way, and they see themselves as good custodians of that wealth.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about a group of people who also worry about what people think about them, but for entirely different reasons. I'm going to talk about the Scroungers. Scroungers, as they've come to be known, but people have essentially, through their lower status in society, have been regarded as social outcasts. They've been shunned, basically. So I'm starting sort of at the bottom in terms of income scale, in terms of who gets what and what their life's about. If you don't mind, I'm going to use the book because I want, you know, the people's voices in here matter a hell of a lot more than mine, so I do want to quote them rather than paraphrasing, if that's okay. So I'm going to start with Amy. Amy's a 20-something girl. She's got a chronic disability that she'll never recover from. She always has to manage it. She has mental health issues as well, sometimes related to the disability. She started campaigning because she really couldn't believe the amount of abuse that was being hurled at people who, for whatever reason, had to claim benefits, whether they were benefits while they were in work, whether it was disabled people claiming benefits. And Amy spent a lot of her time wondering what people thought about her. She spent a lot of time behind closed doors, worrying about going out in the street. You know, abuse against disabled people has gone up. Anyone who looks at these issues knows that. But she began to feel like her and everyone like her was being told that they had no value in society, that if they needed benefits to survive, you know, just to have a basic quality of life, they were somehow social leeches. So I just want to sort of read a little bit of what Amy had to say and what she told me about her experience of living in today's Britain. She goes, "I know society doesn't accept me. To be honest, I don't accept myself. I claim employment and support allowance and disability living allowance, amounting to about £221.80 a week." Another big distinction with the rich, they have no clue how much money they have. People know to the penny what they have when they're at the bottom of the social scale. "I wish I didn't need it, but the truth is, without this money, I couldn't survive. In my everyday life, I am made to feel an outcast, unwanted, and alone. The more I feel hated by society, the more I hate myself. I don't think society knows this, the way they make us benefit claimants feel behind closed doors. Maybe we are guilty of not talking about it enough, but maybe society is also guilty of not being ready to listen. What I'm saying is, please don't put us all in one box. We are doing our best, so please try not to judge us."
Emmy was, she's an incredible person, really, and the fact that she's become outspoken on these issues and stands up for other people in similar situations is incredible to me. Now, she was going through that lovely process of being assessed of being fit for work. Amy and people like her are being told that even though they have a chronic condition that is not going to be cured, it's only managed, that, you know, if they're having a good day, then they're fit for work. You know, what Amy illustrates for me is the level of disregard that, and almost contempt that we've reached for people who are really struggling, for people really just doing their best to get by. And there's a duty on us to talk about and with people like Amy, because if their voices aren't heard, then only the people at the top ever get heard. So I'm going to pass back to Dominic, because he's going on to further.
Okay. Back to the other extreme again. I'm now going to come down to the 0.1%, the best off 1 in 1,000 people. These are people getting up to about $1 million a year in income. But they differ from those richest families in that they have to work. They often, or almost all in my experience, have share portfolios and so on. They have wealth, and that wealth is amassing, but they're having to work. The group I'm thinking of are international investors and hedge fund managers, because I happened to be lucky enough a few months ago to spend a few days with 2,000 of them at a conference for international investors and hedge fund managers. And the kind of scary things about such an event are, it's amazing to see so many people with so much money all wearing the same black suits. It felt like the Men in Black kind of thing. And some women, and women dressed in a particular way, which was required to be dressed in that way. But these people work, and they actually work very hard. So at an international investors conference, what happens is that companies come along who are doing things like putting new mobile phone networks into China, and they try to show that their scheme is going to be profitable because they need the money from these investors. These investors are wanting to make 10 or 20% on their money a year. They may be investing the money from the people above them, or from very large pension funds and so on, but they themselves are getting 400,000, 500,000, up to $1 million, maybe a bit more, for all I know. And the kind of thing that I found unusual talking to some of these people was that when we talked about people, they didn't use the word people. The word they used was labour. They talked about the labour, the problems with labour, being nice to labour, corporate responsibility for labour, ensuring that your supply chain was audited so that you wouldn't become unstuck. But there was the labour and there was them. And they could work in any country. At that point, at that level, you can get passports and visas to be anywhere. You're mobile. But you have to work. And the assumption amongst the group appeared to be that you're different. You're clever. You're very special. And you're essential to the workings of the world economy. It's you and your effort and your nous for moving your money around that makes everything else work, and the rest of us just don't get it. We don't understand that they're so special and we're so fortunate to have them. And it's because of them that we have mobile networks at work, it's because of them that new airports are built, it's because they're being careful with the well-earned money of their clients and themselves, that the world economy is operating as it is, and they need governments, which they don't have a very good impression of. You see, you may well think from below that government isn't great. They don't like governments. The important thing of government is to get out of the way and let them run the world well, because the free market is the only show in town.
Okay, my second scrounger, who's obviously almost single-handedly responsible for the financial crisis, is called Emma. And Emma's just a bit further up the social scale in terms of earning, or was, until two things happened to her. The first was that in the first wave of austerity cuts, Emma was made redundant from the NHS. Not long after, she fled her home because she was a victim of domestic abuse. She grabbed her daughter, left her home with nothing, no handbag, nothing. Now, someone in Emma's situation before the legal aid cuts began coming through, which, as anyone who looks into this knows, a huge amount taken out of legal aid, could have gone to a solicitor and got the first piece of advice free to see what help they can get. And she couldn't do that. She sought out a refuge. Well, there were fewer refuges in the area that she lived in because, guess what, they've been cut too. Somehow, someone in one of the refuges did help her out, helped her get a conversation with people at the council so that she could find a home to live in, helped her find a solicitor who just did some pro bono work for her to get her and her daughter set up so that they weren't going to be hunted down by the person that was chasing them. Now, Emma, as someone who had worked her whole life in a professional job, was completely destabilised by all of this. But what was interesting about her was how shocked she was at the way she was made to feel afterwards. So it wasn't just that she fell on hard times or some unfortunate things happened to her. It's that once they did, it had to be her fault. You know, it was her fault she was beaten up. It was her fault that her job was cut. But what's extraordinary is she began to rebuild her life with the help of people who, even a few months before, had a bit more money to get her on her feet faster. But she's getting on her feet. But this is how she describes what was happening to her after having gone through all of that. I've worked every day of my adult life. I've never claimed benefits before, so it's been a massive culture shock for me. I've lost everything. I've lost my home. I want to work. I'm constantly looking for work. I would do anything. Just because I came from a really good job that was really well paid doesn't mean I won't go and clean toilets. They're expecting people to go out and get these jobs, and saying there are jobs out there, and they'll retrain, but there aren't the jobs out there. What do they want these people to do? I mean, in many ways, she sums up a lot of people's experiences, especially the people who, you know, might have been on a decent living, or might be on the cusp of a decent living, and now they find themselves thrown into a jobs market that's unstable, where wages are low, where even if you have got qualifications, it's very hard to get a job that pays you in accordance with it. When you go to the job centre to say, maybe I should do some retraining, the people at the job centre are told to say, well, you've got to fill in these forms. You've got to prove you applied for 10 jobs that are totally inappropriate today. Otherwise, we sanction you. You know, the ludicrousness of someone like her, who's a professional person, walking into a job centre and saying, no, I want a job that I can support my child with on my own and not rely on state benefits. And, you know, escape this kind of trap that people often find themselves in. And yet, she can't. She's stuck. She lives in a part of the country where actually there are 60 people chasing every low-paid job. And she can't just up sticks and run. You know, she needs a bit of family support. She needs the support of people who are helping through the domestic abuse issues. But she is not a one-off. She's not untypical. But stories like that aren't told enough. You know, we don't hear enough from the people who are inadvertently the victims of austerity. Instead, we hear about the largesse of the wealthy who want to, you know, donate money and be seen to be these great philanthropists. Frankly, for me, the people who are giving up their time for free to help people like Emma, they're the true philanthropists in society. You know, they give everything they have to people like this. And yet she opens the newspaper and she hears the same things that Amy hears every single day, that she's worthless.
Funding for women's refugees is being cut. At the moment in this country, government funding is being cut, so there are fewer places. So what does the charity do? One of the charities do, which is trying to keep the beds available, what they do is they go to the rich. They go to the rich and try to get them to make donations to keep refugees open. And what do they find when they do this? They may get promises. But if you're thinking about charities that the rich don't necessarily want to be associated with, women's refugees actually count quite highly. So they get many more promises than they actually get any donations to replace the state and to keep the refugees open. And what does a charity do when it can't get the money from the rich that was promised to them? It can't say anything. Because if they complain that these rich people promised the money for refuge and they didn't deliver it, they're not going to get any money from anybody. So you don't hear these stories because these stories can't be told. But my last story isn't about people, well, not necessarily people with enough money to be able to fund refugees. It's about the bottom end of the 1% and where they are. I had a conversation recently with a pretty well-off couple, a very successful couple in London, probably a Labour supporting couple, even though they were very well off, and they were very aware that they were in the 1%. But they asked me about, well, where is the boundary? Where's the 1% start and stop? And I told them, well, if you haven't got kids, it's 160,000. And they turned and looked and said, well, that can't be right, because that means that our children are in the 1%, because their children were earning 160,000 in London as a couple working as a lawyer and whatever else, but only just over 160,000. They said, but our children aren't rich. Our children can't be in the 1%. We're having to help them get a house. So how can our children be in the 1% when we're having to help them to get a three-bed house in a fairly nice part of London? And so all the way through the 1%, which is so very, very different, you find ignorance, but different kinds of ignorance. And people at the bottom of this group feel that they are struggling. Housing is the main issue, and the bulk of the 1% are in and around London. But the next issue after housing, which Melissa will know, is if you're in the 1%, you're almost completely obliged to use the private school system. Now, you could talk about, you know, being a maverick member of the 1% and not and using state schools, but it's pretty hard to do that. So they've got the school fees as well. So they think they're part of the squeezed middle. They think they're struggling. Whereas, in fact, they're the bottom end of the group who've been getting richer and richer and richer since 2008-9. Everybody else in society, the other 99%, have actually been squeezing down and squeezing together. The IFS have shown that we're now back to 1990s levels of inequality. It's about to get much worse at the bottom because the cuts are really coming in. The benefit cuts are coming in now at the bottom. But what makes the 1% different from the rest since 2008 is, as a group, they've all got better off in the last 4 or 5 years. But those at the bottom of the 1% may have just got 10% better off. Those in the middle have got 20% better off. And as you head right up to the top of the 1%, you're seeing incredible increases in income and wealth. So within the 1%, people feel stretched and they don't think they're doing well. I'll end on just one last stat, and then I'll end with passing over to Mary for the last story. But the last statistic to give you on this is one that came out of Credit Suisse, the bank, a couple of weeks ago. Credit Suisse produced the World Wealth Report. Last year, the World Report said the 1% of the world, the best off 1% of people in the world, had 41% of all wealth in the world. A couple of weeks ago, they released their latest report, and they said the best off 1% in the world have 48% of the wealth in the world. That's a 7% increase in 1 year. If that were to happen for the next 7 years, the top 1% will own everything on the planet. What that needs to tell you is that you are living through the most remarkable times right now. And this absolutely numerically cannot continue. It's not a case of saying it's bad, I can't continue. There is no way in which the current huge growth and take at the top is sustainable, because you can't have 99% of the planet's population having absolutely nothing in 7 years from now. So something's about to happen. Don't know what it's going to be. Might just be a slowdown. We might just sort of steady on at this kind of rate. The landlords might carry on buying up houses in London. But what you can almost certainly say is that this year, last year, the year before, these are some of the most unusual times that you're ever likely to live through in your life.
Craig could have been a poster boy for any of the main political parties right now. You know, he's a hard-working family, right? He'd worked his way up from school at 18 in an engineering firm, you know, became a team leader, got a mortgage, looked after his kids, you know, was doing all right for himself. And then in a single day, it all came crashing down because he was made redundant. He was made redundant in a part of the country, again, where there aren't any jobs with equivalent salaries being paid. His only options, if he stayed in those areas, were to take a low-paid job. Now, Craig decided that, you know, he had some skills. He had earned a few skills over the years, you know, a lot of work, a lot of technical expertise. So he decided he would retrain. So he took his redundancy money and put himself through some courses to enable himself to open a caravan repair organisation. He lives on the coast, lots of tourists coming through. Good business idea. He has to sign on in the meantime while he's doing these courses, so he goes to the job centre and he explains what he wants to do. And they say, well, as long as you apply for the requisite number of jobs, you'll be fine, not a problem. So off Craig goes, pays for his own retraining so that he can set himself up as an entrepreneur, you know. He's going to be one of these people that we hear about every time the job statistics come out. Oh, we're a country full of entrepreneurs, you know, we're really go-getting. Forget the fact that it's most people doing part-time work and being paid shit, frankly. So Craig, talk to me about heartfelt, to go from really, you know, this self-reliant, supposed hard-working man who supported his family, who, you know, you hear about from politicians day in, day out, to basically being, you know, a pariah. And he talked also about his colleagues, because all of them were laid off at the same time, and about what it meant. They all had mortgages. They all thought they were doing everything right, everything they were told to do to get on in life, and then suddenly it's all gone. Craig's 40, has a couple of teenage kids, you know, he still wants the best for everybody. And he points out that, he says, it's not just the employees at my firm, it's all the businesses that feed off it. So we often don't hear about, especially in a rural community, when a business closes. If a big business closes, all those businesses are affected by it. That's what keeps the local economy ticking over. It affects thousands and thousands of people in the area. The impact is huge. He talks about his colleagues getting really down because, you know, they're all grafters, he says. You know, these are guys who want to work, have always worked, suddenly find that they can't. I had a well-paid job. Try finding a job in this area that pays that kind of money now. They just don't exist. There's the odd job that's good, well-paid, but there's literally thousands of applicants for every job. The prospects up here, there's nothing. I'm speaking to the lads who are applying for dozens of jobs every week and getting nothing. They're good lads and they're wanting to work. There's just nothing for them. There's a stigma with being unemployed. I'd never been unemployed before, so I didn't know anything about the job centre. It's absolutely soul-destroying when you go there. They make you feel like rubbish. They knew I was doing courses to set my business up, but they still wanted to know, what jobs have you applied for? I said, I haven't applied for any jobs. I'm training. And they said, well, we'll take your money off you. So I just signed off. I got no help from them. It was unbelievable the way they treat you. Speaking to friends of mine who are in contact with the job centre, they're at the end of their tether. You know, they're all grafters, and they're being put into that class of people where supposedly they're not. Because of where we were working, a lot of the lads have big mortgages, and now they've got no money coming in. Any job they can get isn't going to pay their mortgage. It means they are relying on the state for benefits. It's crazy. Now, again, these aren't the people that we hear about in the media. These aren't the people who are held up as like the victims of austerity, but all of these people at different levels of society are. Here's a guy who was on 35, 40,000 a year, you know, a good income for where he was living as well, but didn't have to pay extortionate London house prices. And there he was, sort of the classic kind of squeezed middle, if you like, except just pushed even straight out of that and further down the ladder and into a climate of absolute disdain. And I think one of the fascinating things for me, talking to people who were going through these different stages, was their experience of what it felt like. Because we're led to believe that everyone who's in receipt of benefits of some sort is wholly dependent on the state, sits around all day watching TV, etc. We never hear about the people who are churned through the system, and yet we live in an economy where churn through low-paid jobs is probably one of the most important signifiers of that economy. The jobs that are being created right now, low-pay, zero-hour contracts, all of these things, even when you find a job, you know, you can't guarantee what hours you're going to get. You can't guarantee what income you're going to get. We have stories in the last few weeks of landlords saying they won't actually give a lease to someone on a zero-hour contract. So you can have someone like Craig go from, like, a relatively stable existence with, you know, hopes and dreams for his family, and just like that, he could be on the street without the safety net. Now, the thing that is particularly sort of striking for me, and it never really gets reported, is the degree to which the cuts that have been happening are a fraction of what's to come. We really haven't seen the majority of the cuts yet, and yet it's people like Craig, it's all of those people who need a safety net in the times in their lives when they just need a bit of help to get going, that are going to find no safety net at all. You know, something like 40 billion is still going to be wiped off local government. I mean, that's an extraordinary amount of money, and it's almost hard to compute. You know, it's the kind of play money that the rich and famous sort of, you know, spend on racehorses and yachts and all those wonderful essentials of life. But, you know, this stuff needs to be talked about, because the people who use social services are the people who are most in need already. And without anything to turn to. And this includes disabled children, older people, you know, right across society. But not everyone has to care about that, because the people who are making all the money never use these services. So why would they bother to stand up and shout about it and complain about it? But wider society, I don't believe, is aware of what's still to come either. And that it will be your cousin who's disabled, or your grandmother who happens to get dementia and needs a bit of extra help. That's all, you know, a lot of that will be completely disappear, unless you're in a Tory council, because they're only taking 7% of the cuts, of course. But I really think, through the stories of individuals who aren't the typical person who is supposedly a scrounger, that's plastered all over the front page of the Daily Mail, need to be told. And I think through their stories, we actually learn a bit more about what the reality is, rather than numbers telling us what the reality is.
Thank you very much.
Is there anyone who'd like to make a point, ask a question? Yes.
Yeah. I've got lots of questions. The first thing is, it's a statement. I think you really ought to be on a West End stage. Yes. You remind me of a David Hare play, actually. I don't know, because it's such an important story that you're telling, and there's something about the two stories put together that is really, really riveting. I don't know if it, yeah. So that's my first comment. The second, the questions that came to me as you were talking was, do you feel it's immoral? You talk in a very interestingly, not neutral, but the way you talk about it I find fascinating, but I found myself wondering, when you see those people in their black suits talking about Labour, Bill Gates, do you have a moral impulse about it? Something very wrong here. The second question then is about the political process and the state in the middle of that. Because I know that Bill Gates probably trying to counter the North Korea moment was at the House of Commons this week, and MPs were saying how brilliant he was. So that's probably his people doing that. But my perception of the political landscape is that private money has come in and is taking over, particularly in education. It's taking over the state. And the state and elected politicians seem completely helpless in the face of that. So I'm curious about what other role the state might have. And particularly, thirdly, the Labour Party. Sorry, that's three questions.
I'll start.
Yeah. It's to both of you, it's not just...
Yeah, I'll start. That there are people at the top who are evil and very, very nasty, who are immoral, but...
Can you tell us who they are?
No.
That was the next thing I was going to name.
Oh,
well, the Sunday Times, Richard?
The people advising Ian Duncan Smith on how to make the cuts,
yeah.
Who are not so stupid they don't know what they're doing. But the majority of people at the top are largely unaware of other people, and they're all very human. I mean, the kind of thing I have in my head, I watched... a small convoy of cars arrived at an Oxford college of some donors turning up from a rich family, and one got out, security guards were around, and lighted up a cigarette because they're obviously worried about going into the social function. And I thought I was lighting up a cigarette at the same time, because I have problems going into Oxford colleges still. I thought, this person is a human being. They're just a human being with many, many billions of pounds, but they still wanted a fag before they went in. And they're completely sheltered from the outside world. They get driven and flown to places. It hits you the first time you're sitting, eating a meal with investors, particularly if they're paying for it, and you suddenly realise they're using different language to you, and you realise that they do think that other people are genetically different from them, and it's all a bit nasty. But my main impression is ignorance, just incredible ignorance at the top of other people's situations. They do think that people are lazy and have to be forced to work in the factories. They want to be nice to people, but in the same way that people often talk about being nice to animals. What you hear is the kind of thing you hear about, can we do battery farming of chickens nicer? It's the sort of same. If you just, in my head, I kept on thinking, if we were discussing chickens here, would it be any different? And it's upsetting the first time you hear it, but when you hear it more and more, you can get a bit used to it. And I ultimately think we have a huge problem of ignorance across the classes, and it's a bit the play that's come into my head in the last year is in Inspector Calls, if you can remember that. And it feels like that. I mean, that play was about, it was written after the war, I think, but about before the war. Yeah. We're now back to 1936 levels of inequality, and we're heading towards higher. And if you think about that play, and about how the upper class behaved, and about the fact that the young girl who killed herself didn't matter to them, it's immoral in the same way, but they behaved in that immoral way because that's how other rich people around them were behaving at that time. And that kind of immorality reduced collectively. It didn't reduce because an individual rich family decided to not be so nasty. It became wrong, seen as wrong, to be like that. And the problem is it's become seen again as right to be like that, right to have servants, right to see that you yourself should be able to have a very different life to other people because you're somehow different.
It made me think of a lot of things, so try not to waffle on in my normal Irish fashion for hours on this, but one of the things that your questions made me think about was the fact that how readily we accept a narrative that is well structured, well told, and given to us through a media that is compliant with the wealthy and the politicians that are in their pockets. Now, the two countries you see this most in are the US and the UK, which are the two places I spent most of my time in. So we've somehow come to accept the idea that A, tax is a bad thing, you know, full stop, when actually tax is what makes our society work and what makes the world go round. You know, we really need to pay our taxes. B, that if you do have to pay them, well, it should be low, and definitely the rich shouldn't be paying their fair share of it, right? So when you tell people that, say, in the US under a Republican president, Dwight Eisenhower, that the top marginal rate of tax was 91% in the 1950s. 91%, right? By the time you get to Bill Clinton, it's down at 34%. And most of that happened under Reagan, first President Bush, then Clinton, then the tax cuts that came with the second President Bush. And that kind of narrative is not alone in the UK. What we are spoon-fed here is, like, you know, the wealth creators, you know, these people need to be incentivized by not paying as much tax as we would like them to pay. You know, we're kicking them for their entrepreneurialism, you know, despite the fact that most of the money is actually inherited and there's nothing remotely entrepreneurial about it. But we're supposed to buy into this thing. And there's something that really struck me the other week. And again, I'll use this American example because they haven't had austerity in the way that we've had it, but they have had the same narrative for a very long time. So, in Kansas, a Republican governor is elected. He's elected on the basis that he's going to turn the economy around through austerity. So it becomes like a little petri dish, if you like, in the American economy. So he says, I'm going to get rid of all business taxes for small businesses because small businesses are the engine of our economy. Now, on that, he's right. Small businesses employ more people overall, so of course they are. So he literally cuts all their taxes. They don't have to pay anything. He said that because I'm doing this, they'll go out and hire people. Right? 2 years in, they're not paying any taxes. The state is $400 million down on its budget. Now, what does the state have to do with its $4 million shortfall, right? It cuts teachers, it cuts social workers, it cuts the people who do public sector work. Who spends their wages in the local businesses that actually generate the profits for those local businesses that would then provoke those local businesses to hire more people? Well, actually, the teachers and the social workers that have just been laid off. So they have no money to spend in the shops. The guys are not paying any taxes, but hey, they don't need to hire anyone because no one's buying anything. And so 2 years after that, it just gets worse and worse and worse. And yet, this guy could still get re-elected. Somehow there's still an idea that this, you know, that free enterprise, free markets, even though that in itself is a complete misnomer because there's always been some form of regulation, just usually inadequate. But just this idea that they are the people that matter, not the people that teach your children or make sure that they, you know, they get to the next stage in life, not the local business that can hire two more people because there's some money swirling around in your local economy. That, and it's a total myth, and yet we buy it. We buy it every single time. And I get really angry and really red in the face and really quite sort of furious and ranty because when you actually look at the facts, they're very different from what we're fed. And the idea that economic growth doesn't happen because of high tax rates is an absolute nonsense, and it's been disproven over and over and over again. The period of highest equality was also the period of highest taxes on the rich, and it was also the period of highest economic growth overall, decade on decade. It's bollocks, is all I can say. So, but if you've got the money to pay a politician to say what you want them to say. And I do, your question on labour, I'll just answer this one thing, because I think that they are almost single-handedly responsible for letting this narrative win. And until they stand up and say, no, do you know what, we didn't cause the global economic crisis, really, yeah, we were a bit soft on regulation, but so were the Tories, but we didn't cause what caused this problem. So for fuck's sake, get over it. Austerity was a choice, it wasn't inevitable, move on.
We've got time for some more questions. Yep, right at the back there. And then,
well,
yep.
You raised the word, Mary, hopeful, so I want to ask, what are the things that you're hopeful for that can give us some of the seeds of what might help counteract some of what you've so brilliantly portrayed? And if you were magically voted to make some changes politically, what would the two or three things that you would collectively do?
Okay, can I just take one more?
Yeah. Yep. Trying to remember those two. Yep.
I just wanted to ask, is there anything that we can do to stop the rich getting richer? Is there anything that we can change, even adopt, or is there anything like in the whole process of the rich getting richer that will stop and kind of hinder their progress and change things around?
Do you want to do that question then, and
I'll
have a go at the others.
Yeah, hope. Yep. There's a huge amount we could do. Kate Barker, who was an economist on the Monetary Policy Committee, middle-of-the-road economist in Britain, has published a little book on housing where she's calling for capital gains tax to be brought in on all increases in property values. That immediately affects the people who've bought the most expensive property in London, and they're only buying it for investment purposes. They're buying it for the profit they're going to make from it going up. If you suddenly slam capital gains tax on that, the value of London property will go down. And if you want to do one thing that will improve the living standards of everybody in the country, it's a reduction in the cost of housing and rents. Mm. It's an across-the-board improvement in living standards because everybody has to pay rent or a mortgage. A few very wealthy people will lose out, but most people will get better off. Now, that's being suggested by a middle-of-the-road economists have suddenly started to get interesting. John Hills has got a bit of... John's a slightly more radical economist, but not that much. But John Hills has a book coming out today about how the welfare state actually gives more money often to the better-off people in society than the worst, because the better-off live for about 10 years longer. So, you know, who actually uses the NHS the most? So it isn't the case that those of us who pay higher taxes are actually getting less. Those of us who pay higher taxes get to use these services more. So a lot of things are beginning to happen, but the gulf between these and what needs to happen is quite wide.
In terms of hope and where you find it, and you do find it in the strangest of places, I suppose the thing that always astonished me... I mean, I've been writing on social affairs for a very long time, so it's not like I'm easily shocked or whatever, and I was often shocked at just the sheer volume of terribleness that was happening, and how fast it was happening, and how few people realised what was happening. But actually also the extraordinary ability people have to face it down, you know. Unlike in previous years where there was a sort of more sort of collectivism, more collective action, trade unions offered a sort of centralised voice for various disenfranchised groups. The difference now, of course, is that that isn't there, but it doesn't mean that spirit isn't there. It doesn't mean that people don't want to fight and don't want to look after their communities. You know, I came across people all over the place who were, doing 20 hours extra stuff a week just to help their neighbours and their wider families. That, to me, is incredible. You know, local, very local grassroots groups who were on shoestring budgets, still managing to pull off small miracles every day, helping someone get their benefits, you know, going to the job centre as an advocate with someone, those kinds of things are extraordinary, because I think as long as those things are still there, the question becomes how do you harness it? And the question becomes how do you tell a different story about it? Which goes to your next question, which what would you do that would change things? And I think first and foremost, I think if we've learned one thing in the past sort of 2 to 3 years, it's that if you do construct a very clear and convincing narrative, people don't have time to deconstruct all the economic documents in the world that you can throw at them, or even to read the stuff that people don't have that time. So whatever the most powerful political message of the time is, if it keeps getting pushed, if it's seen as legitimate, if you make actually the facts work for you, then maybe you can make a difference. So if we don't have an official opposition in Parliament and on news programmes day in, day out, saying austerity was not inevitable, we're not all in this together, some people have done better from it than others, and they weren't the people who needed the help, you can make those very clear messages. And I think once you've done that, once you've harnessed that, then you can start constructing policies that people will actually buy into. Now, the other thing we know is that when the social surveys are done about what people support or don't support, majority of people support nationalisation of the railways. Who knew? Everybody wants the NHS to survive. We don't live in a country of bitter, twisted bigots. They just have a bigger voice right now. So it's about how we get a voice for the people who aren't those people.
Thank you. We've got time for a couple more questions. Yep, I'll take them there.
One other thing I'm wondering, which hasn't come up, and it's obviously not a popular subject, but the shift towards UKIP, and I'm from Denmark, so I've seen it.
You've seen it,
happened in my own society, and how people tend to grasp at suggestions that are never that, well, the people that are rich are actually just taking more money from you. It has to be the people who are worse off than you.
It's a scapegoat.
That are stealing what you need. And one of the things that I wonder is, how do you make that message clear? Many times thought about doing what is the equivalent here, The Sun, but, with the right views and portraying the right messages, but it never works because it's not as easy an explanation to give them. And so at some level, I also think that the people who are trying to get these facts out there have to step beyond the facts and think about the spin that is behind.
But that's why the story matters.
Exactly, the stories that we're telling, because otherwise the scapegoats are going to be, in Denmark now, they're over 20% of the votes, which is scary.
But there have been some countries that have always had a kind of, they've had a sort of large, like France has always had a large proportion of people who vote on the right. It's always been there in a block vote in a way that the UK has never had. This is why this whole sort of UKIP phenomenon is ridiculous. But, really, I blame journalists. Journalists have, in many ways, manufactured this.
And they haven't taken UKIP apart. Lisa McKenzie's just, there's got a book coming out, which is partly about a poor area in Nottingham that she's been studying for years. Where she's noticed, increasing numbers of conspiracy theories amongst people in the poorest part of the state, and beliefs in the Illuminati and so on, and the committee of the very rich kind of dragging them down. In the same place, the same people who are going towards Nigel and going towards UKIP. And what they don't know, and what no journalist has revealed, is if you look at the UKIP leadership and the chief executive and their deputy, they're all very rich people who came from the Conservative Party. If there is kind of any Illuminati, it's actually the UKIP leadership. Yeah. It's an incredible operation, is UKIP, and nobody's actually looking at where is the money coming from, who's at the top, beneath the slightly more mad old gentleman with very disgusting views that they have to get to stand for their councillors. And UKIP is actually being run by a small cabal of Tories who are trying to claim space over that side of the vote. And they could be taken apart simply by telling the stories of who are the people running UKIP.
But it's also disillusionment, isn't it? Because there is a sense here of people not feeling like they have anywhere to go, having sort of semi-truths and half-lies and all the rest of it. It's very difficult to unpick. So if you're a person who would traditionally vote Labour and feels like they're not saying the things that you want them to say, then maybe you look somewhere else. I had a really interesting experience a few months ago with a taxi driver in Kent who is from Rochester. So, he's going to have his say on whether or not UKIP actually get the percentage. And he basically stopped outside the house to drop me off. And we ended up sitting there for another 20 minutes while I explained to him what UKIP's actual policies were. And all he kept saying was, really? Really? They're going to do, yep. And then he's like, but it's not like they're ever really going to get in, is it? He said, me and my mates are voting for them to kick the asses of the main parties because none of them were actually talking to us. Now, that tells you a lot about what people are voting for. You know, it's whether, are they actually voting for these people and what they say? Some cases, just because there is a fear around immigration and all of that. Or are they voting against something else? And it seems to me that a lot of it is just like a sort of primal howl of anger at the political system, full stop.
And protest vote.
Yeah, and it's whether you feel represented or not. Now, whether you're on the right or the left, if you don't feel represented, there's something seriously wrong with your democracy. I mean, there really is something seriously wrong with it. And UKIP fills a void for some of those people. But I'm not entirely sure that the media concocted myth around UKIP is as strong as it, or as, you know, has such deep roots. So I think that could be destabilised with a, you know, a good alternative.
Coming back to your very strong case for the importance of narrative and shifting it, you've described that, it's been articulated in all these places. Why do you think the opposition have not run with that narrative? Why have they continued, if anything, to sit on the edge and reinforce the scrounger, the hardworking narrative, which implies that they agree with austerity, although they may contradict it in more official statements, it implies that austerity was necessary, and also that they were partly to blame for it.
Well, I think the first thing that strikes me is that I don't think the current vilification of people would have been possible had the Labour Party not opened that door.
Yeah.
So in many ways, for instance, when the Labour Party were actually helping people through, you know, propping up wages through in-work benefits and stuff, which helped people get by but didn't challenge the low wage culture, well, that was a good thing, but they didn't shout about it, right? So they didn't really want to shout about the stuff that they were doing, which would be seen to be helping the scroungers already. The language that's currently used was already beginning to drip in, so it made it sort of easier to get harsher once they had the excuse of austerity to level it. But I think the Labour Party, I don't know, I mean, the people in the room will know more about this than me probably, but I really feel that they're afraid and they're timorous, and they are terrible things for a political party to be at the same time. Because really, you know, they didn't cause it. You know, they fucked up a lot of things, but they didn't do that. You know, so it's okay to stand up and be sort of, you know, contrite about some of the things that you've done and say we could have done better for you. You know, but then actually say we are going to do better for you because we're not going to be austerity light. There's no need for this permanent. You know, we can stimulate the economy in a different way. You know why? Because for the government, that's what we can do. Believe it or not, we can do it. But they're terrified of being accused, obviously, by a very powerful right-wing media of suddenly dumping money in the hands of all of these scroungers that are knocking about the place. That's why it persists. And I, for the life of me, can't understand why they're running in fear of something that is factually correct and that have enough people lining up behind them. A lot of economists who were warning about this stuff in 2009 and 2010, and, you know, big name economists saying, don't do it. It's never worked in the history of economies. It's never worked. I don't know if that answers it, but otherwise I'll just shout some more.
Did you want to come? We've got somebody at the back. Yeah.
Yes, are there any other countries or economies that we could learn from? I'm thinking mostly of Scandinavia.
We're the most unequal country in Europe, so we can look almost anywhere. and it's kind of good news. I mean, there's a kind of good news in that we have got to such an extreme point now. George Osborne's future cuts are designed to get our public spending beneath that even of the USA. So we'll be the worst country in the OECD. There are loads of places you can look if you want to know how to run a school system, if you want to know how to run housing, if you want to know how to give tenants decent rights and get a private renting system that works, or at least works much better than our one. We can look all over the place.
I thought your stuff on Japan in your book was interesting, though. You know, when you were talking about the fact that the multiples of income amongst the top earners in Japan is so much less than it is here.
It's so much lower, and it changes the culture of a place. I mean, I was in Japan shortly after the tsunami, and it was so different from Katrina. In Katrina, people got out guns and started shooting at people, treating them really badly. In Japan, people were simply trying to get stuff to send to the people. And so the university I was in, they were trying to get skin cream because everything else was being sent. And so they were collecting skin cream to send. I was at the census offices in Tokyo, and they were dismantling the huts that they were using to analyse the census forms in, the temporary huts they put up every 10 years, taking them down to put them on a lorry to send them so that people could sleep in them of their own volition, not because some government minister had told them to, because people in Japan see other people as human beings. And that's what you get in a more equal society. Barclays Bank pays more people over £1 million a year than they pay that much in the whole of Japan in every single industry put together. We are such different places. Japan's not a utopia, but things are done in very different ways when people have to share the same society in the same environment. So there's lots of places to look. And throughout history, whichever place has been the most extreme tends not to stay in that situation for a large amount of time, because it's very hard to maintain that position. But the hard question is, what do you do if you're Norway or Finland or Japan? Where do you look at for how you ought to change in future? That's difficult. But coming from the UK, I wouldn't dare suggest to people in these countries anything that they do.
Is there anybody else who'd like to come in? And then I think what I'll do is I'll take another question, and I'll ask you both to sort of answer and make concluding remarks, and then hopefully stay around for a bit afterwards if you want to grab Mary or Danny one-to-one. So if I take you there and then...
Sure. I'm wondering if you consider unconditional basic income a viable option at the moment.
Basic income is the idea of people simply by right getting a certain amount of money a year, and it exists in Alaska, about $3,000. It exists in the north of Norway. I think Brazil's brought one in. We have it for pensioners. Pensioners in this country get a basic income. Some people with kids get a basic, so it already exists. I think the most likely way to get a decent basic income in is EU-wide, because the EU currently has the messiest set of pensions and welfare regulations anywhere in the world, and people have the free movement to go across these. So young Europeans who have been in more than one country are suddenly going to begin to twig that they're going to find it very hard later in life. Like I said earlier, John Hills has shown how we all tend to get out from the system what we put in. But that breaks down when you move between countries. Europe, or at least the Eurozone, could introduce a very small basic income, maybe just €1,000 a year for all Europeans. Do you get as a right to being European? It allows you to get rid of certain quite hard to give out benefits, because you know everybody's getting €1,000 a year. It encourages people to stay in poorer parts of Europe, because €1,000 goes much longer in Eastern Europe than it does in Germany. And if you can get it in on principle, then you can begin to raise it up so that by our grandchildren's time, you're looking at the kind of basic incomes that the Basic Income Trust are arguing for. But I think either Europe splits apart, or Europe's going to have to go for a basic income, because there's no way of reforming all these separate systems that easily. But you can put it in, raise it, and slowly dismantle all the separate systems in each country and leave them as legacies for people of our age. And everybody else simply gets what they get as right as being part of Europe, because we see all Europeans as people.
There's really not much I'd want to add to that. The only thing that I think about around this is in the conversations that we're currently having around a living wage and the minimum wage, and my worry if the debate stays in that area as opposed to basic incomes is that we sort of create actually quite a low sort of starting point, when really we need to be a bit more ambitious. If we were taking account of inflation for what the minimum wage should be, and you write about this in your book, don't you, Danny? So the minimum wage now would be £18 an hour if it had followed inflation. So in many ways, we set our ambition so low that we allow the debate to circulate around the bottom. instead of saying, ah, hold on a minute, we should be here, not here.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. I think all our events now should always have two authors coming along. We should always do it. I think it's been a great success. So can you join me in thanking Danny and Mary?